Hello, welcome to the Africa Climate Conversation podcast. I am your host, Sophie Mbogwa. As I promised you last week, we are starting a new series looking into communities and how they are adapting to climate change. So this week we are starting from a village called Ngoilale Village in Masai Mara, Narok West, in Kenya. This is a county that hosts the Masai Mara National Park, where you get to witness the wild beast migration every year. For ages, the Maasai people roamed and grazed their livestock. They moved long distances in search of water and pasture. The land was communally owned and shared with the wild animals. But over the years, the need to access education, healthcare, and other services has forced them to adopt a sedentary lifestyle, settling in one area. The sedentary lifestyle has seen the communally owned land subdivided into individual shares, balancing the need to keep large herds of livestock, protecting the traditional wildlife migratory corridors, and adopting new food production methods has raised a conflict challenge. Most of the Maasai landscape is arid and semi-arid. In most cases, both people, their livestock, and the wild animals share the same water resources. Now, with drought periods becoming frequent and more prolonged, competition kicks in during the dry season as both meet at the watering points. So the wild animals will kill people and the humans retaliate, killing these animals. Now, to minimize this conflict, with the help of the County Development Fund, community contribution, and well wishes from the Netherlands, a community at the Ngoilale village in Masai Mara, Narok West, this neighboring the Masai Mara National Park, conserved natural springs located in a communal conservancy. They built a 100,000-liter underground tank where the water accumulates before it's pumped into another outer tank. From this tank, it's then pumped by gravity 13 kilometers into the villages, and some of this water is directed to open wells where wild animals quench their thirst from. Around the tank, they planted bushes and trees, then protected the land by registering it into a conservancy. Governed by the traditional rules, no one is allowed to cut a tree or graze there. Here is Nelson Ole Kirokol, the Ngoilale Community Development Organization manager, on why it was necessary to protect the springs.
Before we protected the spring, we used to go down to our seasonal rivers and we scoop the sand and wait for a few hours for the water to accumulate. And that is the water we use. And after we leave the spot, the elephants at night, of course, came to the same spot, buffaloes, even hyenas. So they urinate there, they also poop there. And then the following day in the morning, that's the same water that you're going to take. So the waterborne diseases were very high during that time. And it was also very risky because if people are many going to the same spot fetching water, it takes really long. And we've realized a lot of the people were really encountering elephants and other dangerous game as they wait for the water to accumulate. People can wait up to 8 p.m., which is quite dark. But what can you do? You don't have water for cooking. You don't have water for drinking. So you have to wait. So it's actually a need driven why we protected the spring.
Ole Kirokol organization is working with Ngoilale communities to improve access to clean water, education, healthcare, as well as community empowerment. The community is surrounded by 6 wildlife conservancies in the Masai Mara National Park. In a world where boreholes yield salty water, about 7,000 people depend on these springs for clean water. Every household contributed either a goat, a sheep, or 3,000 Kenya shillings for this infrastructure. They access clean pipe water a day at 100 shillings monthly fee that goes into maintaining this infrastructure. But despite the protecting these springs, Ngoilale Community Development Organization Chairman John Olempoi says water is still not enough for both humans and wildlife.
We have done 13 kilometers down villages there. People are accessing clean water. But we have not reached our challenge of our problem because the population of communities is increasing day by day. Mm. and the pressure of water is now reducing. So we still have that problem of water. Human and wildlife conflict has not been solved because actually we still all depend on the same springs. But actually, when we done the protection of the spring, we left some ice where the flows of water can go to wildlife. But actually, still following where the human are accessing their watering points, like elephants, they come down to where people are fetching water, and we still have that problem. Mm-hmm. In the past, water was not a big problem. Because even though we have two major rivers here, one is called Onmerui, and we have Talek River, all are seasonal rivers, but actually because they owe a lot of sands, that sands will catch a lot of water that can never dry up. When the dry spell comes, you just scoop the sand and get water inside. Now we have a big problem that are affecting these rivers. There is sand collection. It has become a commercial to some young men who are doing that selling the sands to people from Narok or other urban towns, and they affected terribly the rivers, and immediately after the rains goes, the water disappeared. So it has become a big challenge, and the protection of the spring that I've talked about is not enough to the whole community. Even so, we get some drilling of some boreholes, but actually they are still not enough to the whole community. Mm. Some other areas are in need of water.
Narok County is among Kenya's top 5 counties with the highest reported incidences of human-wildlife conflict. The county supports about 30% of all Kenya's wildlife, most occurring on private and communal land, and wildlife conservancies outside the state-protected Masai Mara National Reserve. A 2019 report on human-wildlife conflicts and their linkages in Narok County records that from 2001 to 2017, the county experienced nearly 14,000 conflict incidences involving 13 wildlife species. The elephant contributed nearly 50%, while the leopard, the spotted hyena, and the lion jointly contributed 16.4% of all reported conflict cases. Crop raiding reported 50%, attacks on human contributed nearly 30%, and livestock attack contributed almost 20% of the cases. But apart from the water challenges, what else causes human-wildlife conflicts? I posed this question to Yusuf Aden, a National Wildlife Program Manager at the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, and this is what he had to say.
Water is very, very critical in terms of causing human-wildlife conflict. But water is just one of the issues that causes human-wildlife conflict. Human-wildlife conflict is much, much more complex than that. There are a number of reasons why human-wildlife conflict happens. Maybe just to give you a general idea of why human-wildlife conflict is becoming a big issue, even more than, sometimes wildlife crime or poaching, which is in most times highlighted in most of the platforms and media. One reason is because, of course, human population is increasing. Wildlife population at the same time is increasing because of all the conservation efforts that are going on. And because human and wildlife share the same space, for humans, they will need that space for different things. They would need it for settlement. They would need it for, different land uses to support their livelihood. For instance, agriculture. For countries like Kenya, which are now developing, you would see things like infrastructure, whether this is roads or railways, or dams, et cetera, so different types of infrastructure because of countries developing. And from wildlife perspective, there are some migratory species which would require to move from one area to another. Some species require huge spaces. Maybe just to give you an example, elephants, for instance, would require huge space because they require a lot of food per day. Another elephant would require about 300 kilograms of food every day. They would require water every day or once, you know, on alternate days. They also have to migrate from one area to another depending on the climatic conditions and, you know, the weather patterns and rainfall patterns and so on and so forth. Some of these animals have traditional routes for migration. And I'm still talking about elephants. They usually use specific routes to migrate from one area to another, you know, seasonally. And if these developments, whether it is agriculture or it is infrastructure, blocks their traditional migratory corridors, then what you get is basically human-wildlife conflict. And in the process, of course, people's properties are destroyed, whether it is crop destruction. In extreme cases, people lose their lives or they get injured. And elephants also get killed in the process. So the major driver is on the wildlife side is this habitat loss, loss of dispersal areas, loss of corridors. And then basically it is the competition between development and conservation, if I would call it that. And then the other major driver is lack of land use planning. Because if, you know, there is clear land use planning, there is clear zoning where wildlife migratory corridors are zoned and protected, where areas which are arable and good for agriculture are set aside for agriculture, but measures are taken to ensure that either these crops are protected by, you know, surrounding it with some electric fence around their boundaries. It allows wildlife to pass through without destroying these crops, and also organizing where infrastructure is supposed to happen, depending on which infrastructure we are talking about, whether it's roads or settlement, etc. If land use planning is done very, very well, I think to a large extent, human wildlife conflict could be resolved. However, there are issues of climate change as well. We know that we are experiencing frequent and prolonged droughts than we used to experience in the past. And this, of course, then causes insufficient forage for wildlife, inadequate water for wildlife, even in big protected areas. Just to give you an example, when you look at Tsavo Conservation Area, it's about 40,000 square kilometers, and it has only about 12,000 or so elephants now. In the 1970s, when you look back, Tsavo Conservation Area had about 40,000 elephants, and you know, it was able to sufficiently provide for that number of elephants. And the reason is because there weren't as much, you know, frequent and prolonged droughts as we are experiencing now. But with 12,000 elephants now, you would hear that Tsavo Conservation Area actually tops in terms of the incidences of human wildlife conflict. In a year, you know, about 10 people could be trampled by elephants. Not because the size of that protected area has reduced, but because of the impacts of climate change. And in the past, there used to be about three rivers which are, you know, permanently flowing in that ecosystem. We have the Galana River, we have the Chiva River, and we have the Voi River. And in Tsavo West, there is the Tsavo River, which joins to Galana River. And these rivers were permanent, and for water-dependent animals like elephants, I mean, they have plenty of water and they have enough space where they can be able to roam around and forage. But now, out of all those rivers, there is only one permanent river that remains, which is Galana. The rest of the rivers are either perennial, and some of them only flow during heavy rainy season, like Voi River. The reason is because, first of all, impact of climate change, we do not receive as much rainfall as we used to receive in the past, but also the impact of anthropogenic factors, you know, water over abstraction upstream because of unsustainable agriculture that is happening around these rivers, a lot of siltation getting to these rivers. And also, most often we see sand harvesting happening in these rivers, et cetera, et cetera. And because of all these challenges, around some rivers, you would see, for instance, horticulture coming up, and a lot of this agriculture are unsustainable, requires a lot of water, and most of the time happens in arid and semi-arid area in environment which is not even meant for agriculture in the first place. All these challenges compound the problem of human-wildlife conflict.
But Yusuf, is there a solution to human-wildlife conflict?
There is no, one solution to this problem. Different organizations are now trying to look at what are, holistic framework that can be able to address human-wildlife conflict. And one of the framework that is being used by WWF and other organizations in Asia and in other parts of the world, and which has proven to be fairly successful, is an approach we call the safe system approach. And the difference between this approach and a lot of other approaches that have been used in the past is that previously people look at human-wildlife conflict as something that you can react to. An elephant leaves a protected area, it goes to a water point close to a protected area where communities live. Then what a conservation organization will do is either translocate that elephant or send a response team to basically drive the elephant back to the protected area. There is a lot of farming, crops destroyed by wildlife. Then quickly organizations would put an electric fence, and it is assumed that now that problem is solved. When you look at it deeply, that is basically treating the symptoms of the problem and not treating the drivers of the problem. And what I mean in this case is there are different interventions that can be applied in different human-wildlife conflict incidences, depending on the nature of that conflict. If one is able to understand, holistically the whole human-wildlife conflict system in a landscape. What I mean with that is, if you're looking at a narrow landscape, which we are talking about today, there are areas where, for instance, interventions which prevent human-wildlife conflict, like electric fences or, proper land use planning or conservation education, might work very well. There are other areas where effective response to conflicts might work very well. And there are other incidences where what you need is mitigation. Basically, giving communities, for instance, an alternative livelihood that is compatible with wildlife, like, for example, beekeeping or cultivating crops that are not palatable to wildlife, or maybe giving a consolation or insurance schemes, those kind of things. There are other solutions which might lie in the policy. And however much response or effective response that you have at the landscape level, if you are not able to resolve the weaknesses in wildlife policies or in other policies that are related to wildlife, like forestry policies or water resource management policies, then you might not resolve that problem. Just to give you one example of how a policy can be able to resolve human-wildlife conflict in some instances, in Kenya, all county governments are supposed to be doing their special plans by law. They are supposed to look at the whole county and be able to zone the county depending on the different land uses that are most appropriate for different areas within the county. And what happens in that kind of policy is that there is clear zoning of where protected areas are supposed to be, very clear zoning of where agriculture is supposed to happen, very clear zoning of where settlements are supposed to happen, etc. And once that is done, then you are able to preempt the human wildlife conflict situation that would have arisen because of maybe people settling in the wrong places, in dispersal areas, corridors, or maybe wildlife a protected area being established in an area which is favorable for agriculture. So you are able to preempt that, and you are able to organize the landscape so that it is, reducing human-wildlife conflict, but you get the optimum production from different sectors that you are interested in. And then the other aspect that is very critical is understanding the conflict itself. It is very important to understand which species causes this conflict. In Narok, for instance, lion and elephants are, the top two species that causes conflict, depending on which area you're looking at. If you're looking at Transmara area, then you need to look at human wildlife conflict interventions that will address elephants specifically, because that is where Nyakweri Forest is, and that is a favorable area for elephants in general. But it's also an area where communities do or practice agriculture as a form of livelihood. But if you go towards Siana area or around Oldekesi, Kikorok, etc., the conflict that you are supposed to be addressing is mostly predation, because that is area which is favorable for lions, and there are specific interventions which are more effective for lion. There are others which are more effective for elephants, and therefore understanding which species you are dealing with, but also for these species, understanding their behavior. Are they migratory species? Their habitat use, what kind of home ranges do they have? Their distribution patterns, where are they found most, even within that landscape, because species also choose different habitats depending on their ecological needs. And then finally, there needs to be a very clear monitoring and evaluation mechanism so that one or conservation institution or wildlife managers should be able to look at their data and look at human wildlife conflict patterns, know which seasons these conflicts occur, in which areas do they occur, and what kind of interventions have worked and which ones have not worked. So taking you back to safe system approach, this approach looks at all these human wildlife conflict causes and consequences in a holistic way and tries to address the drivers of this conflict. So it's not just enough to look at water, it's not just enough to look at corridors. It is very important that you have a holistic approach. And also sometimes the solutions of this human wildlife conflict might not be necessarily the very expensive methods that we run to immediately that we see conflict happening, because of being reactionary to the conflict mitigation. I'll give you an example of how monitoring and evaluation and analysis of data becomes very critical in solving human wildlife conflict. The conservation organization in Tsavo Conservation Area, the Kenya Wildlife Service, and different organizations came together recently, and they were looking at human wildlife conflict data, and specifically human elephant conflict, and they analyzed the data of human death cases to understand where do these deaths occur caused by elephants, what time does it occur, and under what circumstances it has happened. And they realized that most of these cases, almost over 60-70% of these cases, are either people who are going home very late in the night, or people who are basically They've gone to bars, they are drunk, and therefore they are walking back home, or even coming back from bars which are located very close to wildlife corridors and dispersal areas, elephant corridors and dispersal areas. So the intervention they took is basically inform the communities who live around these protected areas using local FM radios, because you know they have these aerial patrols that happens within this conservation area. So every time a plane goes up and it is able to spot a herd of elephant close to a community settlement, they would be able to broadcast this information on local radio. And immediately the communities who listen to these local FM radios are able to get, you know, warning in advance and either change their route or, you know, stay wherever they are until the herd of elephant moves away from the routes that they are going to use. The other intervention is basically to close the bars which are located in the wrong places, close to elephant corridors. And because of that, then people can, you know, enjoy their drinks, but in places which are very far and safe from human-wildlife conflict. And these are very simple and cost-effective ways of dealing with human-wildlife conflict. But again, if you're not able to drill down to your data and analyze, then it becomes, you know, impossible for one to be able to realize that the solution could just be, you know, moving location of a bar or informing people in advance so that they can be able to be aware that certain routes are not safe at certain times of the day.
For now, Ngoi Lale community is spending between 30,000 to 40,000 shillings monthly to maintain the water infrastructure. Nelson and his team are advising their communities to invest in harvesting rainwater once it rains and also talking to well-wishers to rehabilitate their infrastructure. Join me again next week as we take another journey into understanding how communities are solving their climate-related challenges. Do not forget to subscribe to this podcast and also following us on Twitter and Facebook. We are finally on Twitter and Facebook at Africa Climate Conversations. You can also listen to this podcast on our website, Africa Climate Conversations website. And remember, it's accessible on every podcast channel out there. That is from Google Podcast to Apple or Spotify, any other channel that you actually access your podcast from. Until next week, kwaheri, have yourself a productive and safe week ahead.